Hello, dear listener. Editor JT here. We're excited to announce that by the time you're listening to this episode, our fall merch drop will be live at deprogramshop.com. Whether you want a little Fidel peeking out of your frocket, a lovingly recreated Don't Tread On Me sticker, or Hakim's patented theory carrying tote, we've got you covered. The drop is live right now through October 15th, so go snag a hat before they're gone. All patrons will also receive a special discount because you're our favorite little piggies. Thanks for your support, enjoy the merch, and now on to the show.
Boys, I was just telling JT, you got something, had his fucking microphone's not working, bullshit. We're gonna get to that in just a second. It's always fucking something. But yeah. I was just telling JT, I'm very tired as always. But we should have had that for the fucking 100th episode.
Oh, yeah. Thing.
Should we make them
montage?
Should we make them go back? No.
Do it again.
But I had this fucking thing today that was just admin. It was hours and hours of fucking admin. I didn't see a single patient. I want to fucking kill myself.
Nice.
I was telling JT in confidence, but you know what? I'm going to air it out. I would rather have 50 patients on the docket, on my list, whatever the fucking correct English is, of just straight prostate exams than do 1 hour of admin. I would rather finger 50 men in a row for 8 hours than have to do a singular hour of fucking admin. I hate fucking admin. You know the I hate the Antichrist thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's fucking, I hate admin. Oh. That's number one. And number two, we hopped on to record, and Yugopnik's, he recently changed tech stuff, and the recording had a delay, and there's always fucking something. We do this every fucking week, sometimes several times a week, and there's always one of us, something doesn't fucking work. Right, it's like when you go to your car or something, and just something is off. You go to your work, and the screen is not working for some whatever the fucking, and you have to fuck around with an ancient VGA cable that they still fucking use.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it's not screwed in. But if it's screwed in on one side, it doesn't work. But if you screw on the other side, it does.
Right. It's always silly bullshit too. It's like, boys, the G key on my keyboard doesn't work. I can't get to Google Docs.
Oh my god! Sorry, so you got me. You're gonna launch into your beautiful voice.
No. I heard apparently that you can judge a person who has a penis's health based on the health of their erections. Dr. Hakim, is that true?
Yes, it is very true. Microvascular health is your the strength and duration of your erections is an indicator of microvascular health. To an extent, you can't kind of like blanket statement that, but if you have decently long-lasting and mighty erections, may I add, then you're in decent health at the very least. You can have a stroke and a heart attack, but it still works. Diabetics sometimes feel bad for them. Diabetics can get severe microvascular issues, and they can have difficulty in that area.
I have a few diabetic friends, so I'll make sure to use this against them.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure, for sure. You can...
As if they don't have enough to deal with.
Might lose. They are some of the people with the greatest sense of humor that I've ever fucking met. And not even, super self-inflicting and, like, it's not like that they talk about having diabetes all the time, but it's always like some like situation. Like, for example, I don't know, 2 weeks ago with a good friend of mine, and I'm like, man, I wish that in like 60, 17 years, we still get together like this, you know, on the table, food, drink, conversation, music, beauty. And the diabetic is like, yeah, you guys are probably going to enjoy it. I ain't going to be there. And I'm like, oh, fuck me. And he doesn't ruin the mood. He just elevates it. But like, no, we get you fixed up and shit, blah, blah, blah. But
the medications for diabetes now are ridiculous.
It's really good.
Like, it's, alhamdulillah, it's a fantastic work.
As long as it's actually available to you.
Of course.
It doesn't cost like half a house. Yeah,
exactly. Like $3,000 a month here, yeah.
Fuck, what the hell? How do you live? You may as well just die. Yeah. What's the point? It's like, I'm alive, but I'm like, I can't do
cost?
Anything.
Yeah.
Oh my god. I bet it's probably cheaper to go and have like a small vacation in Canada.
That's what people do.
Big time.
Mexico, Canada, there are lots of different places where people will go that is cheaper to take the trip, stay there in a nice hotel, get the medication, and then come back. It's wild.
Yeah. I'm surprised like people don't do like homebrew insulin at this rate.
They do
I'm
have sure. some. There are yeah, some. Yeah. There's bootleg insulin that you can get. And it's not like moonshine where it's going to make you blind or something. It's like they know what
Less
they're doing.
These
are medical trained people who are just kind of doing it in the gray market area just because that's the right thing to do. But yeah, it's very interesting.
But what about profits, JT?
What about profits? Yeah, we had I think in Serbia there was like a movement of so-called angel dealers or whatever they call themselves, and cool. they
give meth out for free.
for terminally ill patients, as well as patients who like have diseases that don't kill them, but like it just hurts like a motherfucker. Apparently THC like helped them out a lot with not feeling like they're gonna die every fucking second. Mm-hmm. So it's very illegal in Serbia up until recently. Actually, I think even CBD to this day is illegal.
Really?
So yeah, so they these angel dealers would like for free just make this shit and then give it to people with these sorts of particular really health problems and so on. Yeah, it's very nice. That's fucking community organizing, a part of what we're gonna talk about today and shit. But back to the previous topic. I remember when I'm proud of my little pecker down there, but back when I was vegetarian for 5 years, so like absolutely no fucking meat, like it worked like even better, bro. There's something about just not having, I don't know, oils or whatever. Well. You think age? No, man. Like, I wasn't eating goat. I wasn't eating pig. I wasn't eating chicken. I was just straight avocados and tomatoes and cheese. Well,
let's look it up. Hold on. Let's look it up. Erection. Vegan. Quality.
Cox.
let's take a look. I am not a fucking robot.
No, get
please.
Get that vegan dick. You know, get that vegan dick, as they say. It might really be good.
I don't think they say that.
Consumption of a healthy plant-based diet is associated with a decreased risk of erectile dysfunction. A cross-sectional study.
Suck my dick.
National
there
Health.
You go.
We show that a healthful, that's a new word for me, healthful plant-based diet is associated with less chance of having erectile dysfunction. Yeah, of course, because you have to kind of...
There I guess that goes with the heart health thing, right?
Yeah, exactly right. I wouldn't be surprised. But you got to remember that there's also a quality of patient base or like selection criteria that's missing here. Mm. People who tend to be vegetarian or vegan tend to also care about their health slightly more. Yeah. They tend to exercise more, amongst other things. If you're just going to get a random sample of meat drinkers, they're also probably
meat
heavy
drinkers.
Alcohol drinkers. Meat drinkers, meat eaters. Meat eaters. They're also going to probably be like more than just, you know... they're gonna have certain intake of alcohol.
Isn't that funny? Like, there's a whole conversation about skinny dick or whatever the fuck they call it. Like, super skinny guys apparently are hung as horses and shit.
That's true.
And I don't know. It's like, to me, ignore like biology and health and all this complicated stuff. To me, there's like some sort of like weird karmic justice, and I'm saying this is like a big guy, right? Most likely, the steroided out fucking gorilla motherfucker that, lives in the gym and, like, takes extra chemical stuff so that he gets bigger and swoller and swoller. Yeah. Not very nutty.
His balls are tiny.
Most likely, that guy will, like, not really, fuck your brains out. While the, like...
He won't be able to get erect.
Yeah. Most likely, there you go. Which, I'm not making fun. Now it's going to sound like I'm making... Mm-hmm. Not... Okay, to an extent, I guess I am. Fuck you. Like, you're putting fucking chemicals in yourself to be swole. Yeah. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not going to call that a disability.
Steroids.
Yeah, please do not use steroids.
You should not use steroids. It is a bad idea across the board. And also, by the way, the one thing that you're thinking about, you're just going to get very... It's going to fuck up with your aggression. It's going to fuck up with your mental health.
So much with aggression. So many of my friends have, like, when they were younger, took steroids. And to this day, they have fucking moments where they just click off. And it's extremely funny when you're, like, this, like, normal-looking guy like myself. And you're in a group of 4 or 5 guys that, used to take this. And they're all, like, 130 fucking kilo monstrosities. And then they get in a verbal fight. But they all respect you. And you're just standing in between them, shouting at them to not fucking kill each other because you can't talk to them normally because they literally cannot talk normal. They are shouting their fucking lungs out because their like brain is just wired different or whatever.
Not only this, but also you're not going to put on nearly as much muscle as you think you will. It still takes a lot of work. And by the way, all those new nice muscles that you built, if you manage to even attract any women through this, which by the way, just being a good person and having a good personality will get you much farther in that regard. You're not even going to be able to seal the deal because you won't be able to get it up. What's the fucking point, right? Let alone many other issues like, you shave years off your life because of this shit.
Yeah. I will say, now I do not advocate steroid use. I think it's gross and I think it's irresponsible. But it is interesting to see, like, if you look at bodybuilding competitions and stuff today, they're all juiced up. And so it's interesting just to see, you know, 100% or probably 105% of what human capacity is for muscle growth, because these people, they're basically a different species at this point. It's like a living science experiment.
Space
like,
marines look, shit.
That dude looks like the bull.
I served the emperor.
Yeah.
I'm like fuck, so I served the emperor.
Gears of War looking.
No kidding. It's just fascinating. It's like, wow. Okay, so that's what humans have the potential to look like. It's weird.
There should be a, what's it called, like an Olympics, a steroid Olympics.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting.
Can maximize what the human body can possibly do.
And then they all die afterwards, of course, but it'd be interesting to watch. You know.
Exactly right.
If you like make it relatively legal, which at this point it kind of is, and you invest, you know, scientific research into it, you might be able to make it safer and so on. But like my whole spiel and like perspective at the end of the day is arguably the same one that these same bodybuilders have, is once you are conscious of exactly what you're doing to yourself, and once you're like, okay, getting swole is worth it, because getting swole is my life's purpose, you know, this is my fucking shit, then God bless, bro. Fucking do it. Oh, you want to shave off 50 years of your life? You want to, you know, the little pecker not to fucking work? God bless. If that is what you want to do, then that is what you want to fucking do. It's like, with all, no, that's the thing that, you know, drives you, and you need to take substances in order for it to drive you. You know, not everybody wants to have a 9-to-5 normal job, family, and a dog, Labrador always, that fucking runs outside of your house. Some people want to get swole. Some people want to jump out of planes. Some motherfuckers want to kill motherfuckers. Like, these are all legitimate jobs.
Legitimate.
except if you do it for capital, of course. You know?
Still kind of
communism
legit.
Is good.
just a little.
Socialism right. Good.
Right. JT, you know what to do with this conversation. let people wonder what he's been saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of
murdering and pillaging?
No, speaking of health stuff, I woke up in the middle of the night today and I had two spots on my neck that were just slightly red and a bit like a bump. So they're most likely, what's it called? Mosquito bites. But they are so precariously placed in like hickey area on my neck. And it just, the first thought that came to my mind is, you got me, must have astral projected into my bedroom and gave me a little smooches on my neck.
Why did you tell him, man? I'm like, this is why I'm having problems with my microphone. I'm literally in Iraq right now, like using some random. Like,
giving me kisses at the
I just
into
couldn't
the
help it, man. Yeah.
No wonder I slept so well tonight. I expect fan art. Of Yugopnik, spirit Yugopnik.
Like a vampire.
Me,
like the vampire from Baldur's Gate going into Hakim's
give
apartment.
Me pics. Don't forget, I mean, the blue walls with the fucking with the holes and the eagle statues.
I would have, if that's exactly what I wanted to say, I would have given you much more, baby, but I was like disgusted by your apartment. So I was like, okay, a little kiss on his neck and I leave. You know, like that again meme, I guess we're talking about women's perspectives without actually having women on here. But it's a very good complaint that they have about, you know, you like this guy, he's cute, he's nice, you go to his place and the sheets have not been washed in 3 months, and you go
hey,
to
fuck
the
you.
Toilet.
My sheets are always clean.
And you go to the toilet and he's literally washing his hair with fucking a dishwasher soap and shit. And
okay,
you're like, oh my fucking God. And sneaks out of the apartment.
He's got a single folding chair and the TV on the floor.
I keep an impeccable household, mind you.
Absolutely.
It has been fixed up since the
except
since
the
8 months ago.
The wall and the hiding below the bed and the...
No, that's all sorted now. I'm above the bed, mind you, and all the holes are filled and painted over. So, yeah.
Well,
I made sure
all the holes were filled yesterday. I can tell you that.
Of course, yeah. There we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the D Program. Today we have a very special episode where we're going to be talking about, in accordance with Lenin's very famous work, what we're about to do. All right, everybody knows the fucking with his hand outstretched. But before we get into that, we want to thank our patrons for all the very very generous support that we get from them. We would definitely not be able to do any of this. I would be significantly more tired and even less capable of doing this without their help. That and likewise, we have some banger merch, absolutely flawless fucking drip that's waiting for you people. people, go and check out. We have the new fucking link. I'm not going to sound
deprogramshop.com, baby.
There we go. For all professional. Go check it out. We have fantastic new artwork for you guys.
We're really proud of this stuff. We really like making this stuff.
Give me a favorite piece. Come on.
Pocket Castro.
Mine is Fidel. Yeah, the Pocket Castro has to be. I fucking love that one. That one and the snake.
Yeah, the Ouroboros with the deprogram on the shirt. Yeah,
absolutely fantastic.
I really like the play on the logo of Wagner. The Porky Killers. That is Porky Hunters. That is sick. Yeah. And actually, the patch has been selling a lot. I don't know why not necessarily the T-shirt. I guess because people don't want to wear it in the street.
It's very big
like they're wearing it looks like they're wearing the actual Wagner thing. Like in Eastern Europe, I am not wearing that part of my own merch. I can tell you that. People really like the hat that says, because it's very aggressive, I guess. Relatively LARPy, but very aggressive. Your kids will be Marxists. I like that.
That's
one
fun.
As well. But we try to make the majority of the merch not just, you know, cool drip that you would wear, but stuff that is like outwardly propagandistic, right? So while you're wearing it, you're basically wearing a poster.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, it's not going to convert anybody, but it might trigger a couple of rightoids into rethinking just how cocked they are. Sorry. Yeah. Came back to you.
No, it's completely fine, Habibi. What was I gonna say? It's absolutely fantastic merch. So everybody, please do go take a look. Also let us know what you guys think about it. With all that being said, though, let's actually get into the meat of today's episode, which is what the details or like the inner workings, or more appropriately, the specifics of what happens before the revolution, during the day of the revolution, and then the preliminary post-revolutionary period, because there's a lot of talk of theory, particularly amongst like modern capitalist Marxists or left-wing people within capitalist countries nowadays. They always kind of tend to focus on getting to revolution, but nothing past that point.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I was reading a book recently. It's
you're reading a book? Oh, that's fucking surprising.
Oh my god. It's a big fucking mess for me. I don't read nearly as much as I used to. And
I hate these fucking humble bragging cunts, man. Shut the fuck up, man. I swear to fucking god. Continue. Save as many lives as I used to save before.
It's putting the pee in the fucking.
I only fuck my wife for an hour, not 2 hours, like I used to do before.
I love it.
God.
But yeah, something that I loved, highly recommended book. It's Socialism and Chinese Characteristics, A Guide for Foreigners by Roland Boer. It's a fantastic book.
That looks
book.
Great.
It's really, really good. I highly recommend it. But in it, he specifies how, because he, as a professor, when he would teach in Chinese universities, he would focus a lot on the groundwork of, like, you know, pre-revolutionary theory. And Chinese students were very interestingly uninterested in that aspect. Huh. They were way more interested in the building socialism bit. They kind of almost didn't care about. In fact, he even mentioned some students kind of calling him out and be like, we've already had our revolution, right? It's very based of them.
That's kind of cool,
Yeah, exactly right. But that's an interesting, optimistic. Parallel to have. For us, in all of our respective areas and regions, there has not been a revolution yet. Mm. Inshallah, there will be. Though, the period prior to the revolution, there's a few things that we need to cover in regards to specifics. That means actual detail. This does not mean that we're presenting a blueprint. We're simply analyzing history, seeing what they had done, what worked, what didn't, and we're gonna present it to you guys as food for thought. Of course, there's constant work across many groups in the West and in the East and everywhere else about what is relevant and appropriate for the different material conditions that exist within all the respective regions of the world. That doesn't mean that you should just take somebody else's example and then try to apply it mechanically to yours. Revolution cannot be exported and cannot be superficially imposed. You have to carry out a correct material analysis of your condition, right? If you want any sort of inspiration, Lenin's work on the development of capitalism in Russia, or Mao's work on the class analysis in, it wasn't Yunnan, I don't remember the exact area now, but his work, these are very core aspects. If you want another good example, Batatu's work on the social classes and revolutionary groups within Iraq is a fantastic, like, huge volume about that. That's another example of this. Regardless, enough book recommendations and enough intro. When it comes to the area or the period before the revolution, the number one central thing that needs to exist is organizations. What exactly is an organization? An organization is a group of dedicated revolutionaries. That is usually what is meant with the Marxist-Leninist example. It could be otherwise. It could be student groups. It could be women's rights groups. It could be minority, like either ethnic or otherwise groups, amongst many others. These organizations need to have, number one, a political program. Number two, this political program needs to be based in an analysis, a correct analysis of the material conditions that exist. Number three needs to be based on the mass line. And of course, number four, and this is the most important bit, there needs to be a unified approach towards carrying out decisions, of course, through democratic process and whatnot. But the levels of factionalism, to an extent at least, do need to be limited.
Yeah.
We'll get into these specific details. I'll mention a few points just generally, and then you guys can kind of hop in before I hand it off to you, Gopnik, for the excellent write-up that he has for this. Two examples that exist frequently all throughout our history is, I'm going to use the Maoist terminology for this, but even Lenin had his own terminology for this, the tailing before the masses bit and the adventurism bit. This is essentially when an organization, a dedicated organization that has as its explicit goal revolution and the overthrow of capitalism and the building of the institution of the building of socialism, the group, if it is standing behind the general political impetus of the population, as in the general mass of people is progressing towards a development politically that the party doesn't recognize or the organization doesn't recognize or isn't there theoretically. We're standing at a point of possibly revolution and the party is not either completely unprepared or believes that it's not an appropriate time because of erroneous reasons. There could be correct reasons that it's not the right time. A good example of this would be the July days, for example. The Bolsheviks did not believe that it would be correct to try to seize power at that point, and that's why that failed, and then it required a few months until it could be successful. That's a correct example of analysis that could be like, okay, actually, no, the organization is correct. It's not exactly ready. The conditions aren't yet laid. Another example to the inverse of incorrectly assessing the situation is the example of the Italian Communist Party during the late tens of the previous century, where there was a general strike called and essentially a massive revolutionary movement that was about to take off, and it did in fact take off. Many factories were taken over by workers, certain areas and important administrative centers were taken over by workers, by armed militias of workers, etc. But the Communist Party did not call for the immediate mobilization of all their forces and all the masses that did listen to them. And as a result, that revolution failed and then laid the groundwork for Mussolini's bullshit and just general fascism development in Italy. This was a major, major mistake, and that has resulted because of an incorrect analysis of the situation. But back to my point. Tailing behind the masses basically means that you're not where they are. They're more politically developed than their organization. That is a major mistake, usually as a result of either ossification or general like reformist trends. They refuse to meet the demand for revolution, or because of like ceaseless factionalism that results in basically making the group impotent and way more infighting and focusing on criticizing each other than rather than developing an appropriate analysis of the
group. Or just plain elitism of thinking that because you know, we are party members, we understand more than the masses, and therefore we need to tell them what to think instead of the other way around.
Exactly right. On the inverse, there's many more examples on this, but we can discuss that at a later point. The other side of this coin is ultra-left nonsense, usually adventure.
My flocking favorite.
this takes the form usually of, rather than being behind the masses, they're way far ahead of the masses. The organization isn't more politically developed per se, but they are, they didn't carry out the correct analysis of the situation, or they believe, for example, there's the situationists were like this. If you don't know who the situationists are, cringe French people. That's all you need to know. They're wrong.
It's a little redundant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Except the French communist uprising. But
I love it. Yes. Nice point.
Apologies to the French.
They were kind of the first ones to do it. No matter how much we shit on them, like when you really think about it, kind of the first ones to do it. But, you know, the OG French. No, there's a joke about Balkan people and First World War, Balkan men, like all of the courageous men. The reason reason that it's all like fucking cunts now is because all the men with courage died in World War One. Because, like, for example, Serbia lost 50% of its male population. And the joke that you can use from this context for the French is like, all the French that mattered fucking just got killed in the Paris Commune and everything afterwards, you know. Okay, so Polish. You got like famous eugenicist. There we go. Exactly right.
Moving aside from absolutely unrepentant and very based French racism, or racism against the French more appropriately. People will take this seriously, we're joking. Anyways, the point was the adventurism part. This basically means that either stemming out of elitism or an idea that if we were to make the situation, if we were to try to spark a revolutionary point, then the masses will suddenly wake up and try to carry forward the revolution. This is not right. If you do not carry out the appropriate political work amongst working people and other associated groups that could be allied with the proletarian cause, then what you end up with is essentially a impotent movement with a bunch of very highly motivated but incorrect ideologically placed people. Circle jerking, and if they get arms and whatnot and they try to do something, then all they end up doing is making their group look like essentially a terrorist group. And as a result of this, they end up actually alienating the vast majority of people from the thing that they want to bring forward. A good point on all this was, this is also assuming that revolution is the point of these organizations. If you are of the persuasion that, we can reform, blah, blah, our third, I think, ever episode that we made was reform versus revolution. So do go have a listen there. I'm not going to rehash those points. We're going to get into a little more detail. There are certain practical points or bits of information that can be conveyed. And this is all based on the historical analysis of all successful revolutionary groups. The fundamental first step was the founding of an organization. This organization, no matter where it is, needs to be founded on the correct ideological basis. This correct ideological basis arises from a correct analysis of the material conditions. What does that actually entail? This entails looking at, number one, the class structure of the society that you currently live in. What is the percentage of actual proletarians? What is the percentage of people who would be considered bourgeoisie? What is the class nature of the petty bourgeois groupings in your nation? Are there peasant populations? If so, what is the breakdown of said peasant populations? What is the individual land ownings between all these people? Do they hire other labor, or do they only work their land themselves? Likewise, if you live in a comprador bourgeois country, then are there certain members of the capitalist class that are nationalistic or patriotic in a way that would resist the influence of power, for whatever reason, of the bourgeois comprador class that exists that possibly continues to rule in your country? This was an example, for example, in China. These are all very important things you need to carry out an analysis of. What exactly is the class structure of your society? Based on this, then you know what to target. If the vast majority of your population is peasant-based and you're trying to push a strictly proletarian line, meaning you're only talking about workers and factories or whatever kind of breakdown of labor that you have in your society, then the vast majority of people who would be important in carrying out the revolutionary movement, your words would fall on deaf ears because it doesn't meet their reality. Right. Likewise, if you live in a highly industrialized nation with the vast majority of people being office workers, for example, if you're going to talk endlessly about like peasant interests and basically no peasants exist in your society, then again, that is wasted effort. Likewise, for example, if you live in one of these in-between countries, a lot of Arab countries fall in this sphere where you have a very sizable percentage of what you would consider petit bourgeois ownership, small cafes or bookstores or whatever else, like small offices for things, legal work or notarizing offices, photography places, like no major chains. It's just very small, you know,
mom and
I
pop
own it
shops.
And I, yeah, exactly right. Thank you. You need to have an analysis that would, and a political program that would meet the interests of these people with a proletarian tilt, right? Because that's the end goal, right? The tilt towards socialism. The way that you can make this attractive to them is through creatively analyzing and then applying and maybe even creating novel Marxist applications. And that's why reading theory is important, of course.
Especially for the modern context, adapted to understanding just what kind of population you're working with. Political identity is no longer kind of at the same level of a class identity as it was during most of the previous, let's call them, revolutions of the past. And right now, political identities, for example, using a more modern context, especially the Western one, a lot of political identities are more linked to social issues of this and that sort. So when you are pitching your class-conscious ideas, be it from the proletarian perspective, be it from the PMC perspective, or even the peasant perspective, which arguably almost nowhere except in certain parts of Africa kind of exists, at least not as an identity of a peasant class, but farmers, which consider themselves not even petite bourgeois, but like big bourgeois, but that's a different topic. You need to integrate these sort of social political identities that these particular people have into the messaging that you're pushing forward. Because I don't know, 50, 60 years ago, you go and you say, oh, you know, I'm fighting for factory workers and so on, and that would click. Nowadays, that would click, but how many actual factory workers, mm-hmm. especially, for example, in the first and second world, do you have? And even if you do have a shit ton of factory workers, they no longer necessarily identify as factory workers. They identify as factory workers with this or that or that or that particular set of beliefs. So that's the only thing I'm trying to smudge in, is when pitching to the particular, when cutting up the demographics that you are trying to reach as a particular organization, be it a niche organization or, you know, a mass line thing trying to get as many people in, you need to understand that the way you approach them will very much so depend on the political identity of the individuals that you're trying to get. But that does not mean that you stay away from quite literally the only main point that all socialist organizations need to make, and that is, you know, a class analysis of what is going on. So you take all of these particular social issues that people might really, really care about or be very, very pissed about, and you link it directly, which is would not be a lie at all, but you link it directly because it is the material reality of the world with the class dynamics of capitalism, which cause, for example, racism, which cause homophobia, which cause the male-female relationship or oppression inside of the family, etc., etc. So you can both target people based on class, and that is always obviously going to be the majority of your actual communique as an organization, but also you can target social issues through class analysis. Never get rid of class analysis, obviously, then you just become a fucking liberal. Mm-hmm. And through that, in the modern context, you can reach more identities than you know, just the class identity, which very unfortunately is not as materialized as it used to be, which is super fucked up because it used to be also not very materialist until socialists came and told them, yo man, like, you're an actual pro, like, stop fucking working for the big man, and so on and so on. Sorry, just adding like whatever modern twists to what our forefathers did, at least from my perspective.
No, beautifully added, beautifully put, Habibi. As is my stereotype to say, but the reason I say it so often is because of how beautiful Jochen's points always are. So you can blame him.
No, please always say it. You're like my fucking ideological daddy. Whatever you tell me, beautiful point is like my week is better. So yeah. I'm not even kidding. I wish I was kidding. I know I'm sucking your dick right now, but I wish I was kidding.
After that interlude of extreme bro love. And several ejaculations. sorry. We're getting back to the important point, which is the mass line, and that doesn't mean... I'm sorry. All right.
But wouldn't if you put coke on a dick, wouldn't it get the guy, like, even if the guy doesn't snort, but the guy who has coke on his dick, wouldn't it get him high? At least if it gets on the glands. No. On the glands. Well, not even the glands? He'll get him high if it's on the glands.
No, he won't get high. He'll get slight numbing on the area that it's placed on.
Okay, like on the teeth shit. Okay.
Exactly right. Exactly.
Like, he's like, trust me.
Trust me. Yeah, bro, I've been there.
I put coke on my dick.
Dude, I use like lidocaine and carbocaine. I use them almost daily. Not on myself. myself, like on patients.
I'm really into the numbing sensation.
Yeah. Exactly right. It helps me last longer when one would go.
He's just supporting my theory that, like, secretly, you know, he's hating on alcohol, but he's like the hardcore fucking coke fiend.
I'm the biggest cokehead.
Like, hardcore coke fiend.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Sorry. Lord. Back to the taking.
Back to the
line.
Important material. Yes. Excuse me. The unimportant information. Because that's what people need from this episode. What I was saying is you need to develop a correct political line. All right. The way of you know, carrying out the proper class analysis of your society, that gives you the draft, kind of like the skeleton framework. How do you get to the nitty-gritty details, right? This differs from society in time to time and place to place based on something called the mass line. The mass line was something that was explicitly given a name by Mao, but existed even in prior iterations, even back to the Bolsheviks. That's what peace spread land was. It was an application of the mass line. This is how stupid English is. What this is, I literally is fucking stupid language. What this is, essentially, you try to create a set of questions, essentially, to go to general people of the relevant class background that you're interested in, of the relevant area, etc. And you essentially, based around your political analysis, class analysis of the society around you, you try to present things that you would think would appeal to their particular interests, right? To use an example, in many countries, land reform was a big thing for peasantry. So one application of the mass line would be for these left-wing groups to advocate for and be in constant discussions with regular everyday peasants about concerning the question of land reform, not basically only land reform, but reorganization. So essentially taking out of big land ownings from aristocratic holdings or feudal ownership or whatever, have the latifundia example in Latin America, and distributing it amongst peasants who actually work the land, right?
Yeah.
That's the common phrase that will be boiled down as the person who works the land is the one who owns it. Mm-hmm. Is a very successful example of the mass line being applied and distilled to just essentially a single phrase in regards to the land question. You go to the masses. It always feels very LARPy to say masses, but people understand what I'm trying to say. You go to the masses with this and you present this idea, and then you get feedback from them on this, right? They'll give you your opinions. You sit there and listen because you're there to fucking learn. You listen, you take notes, you go back to the organization who is politically educated and ideologically advanced enough to be able to distill these even further, and then go back to the group of people, the masses that you're interested in getting their perspectives. You discuss with them again and back and forth and back and forth until you distill it to the most core and important and most appropriately correct analysis of the situation in a political form. For example, land reform.
So, before you go on, you do a market analysis on the ROI of your communist propaganda. Yes.
Exactly. Essentially, essentially right. To put it in a very disgusting way.
Disgusting way.
But
guys, we don't have return on investment on this particular peasant class. We need to concentrate on a peasant class that makes between 7,000 and 12,000, because the guys between 4,000 and 6,000 are kind of at this point, we should classify them as lumpens. Lumpens obviously do not support our fucking cause. I'm sorry. I can imagine like a future like corporate, like they're sitting in a boardroom, a bunch of commies, and like, look at this. This is not what you suppose. This is like, I'm sorry, please go on.
This brings a very excellent point, as always, into the, you know, prior, like pre-revolutionary buildup, which is a lot of people don't realize just how many of their everyday skills actually translate over into organizational abilities. And this is a perfect example of it in Yugopnik's case. JT, of course, his extensive ability at general propaganda propagandizing, as well as video editing and editing of texts and scripts and whatnot. This is indispensable in this example. My skills, which are more quote unquote traditional, I guess, come in the very simple form of, yeah, we're going to have less doctors after the revolution because of war or conflict or essentially brain drain. This is a common thing historically that has happened. So it's not surprising to assume that this would happen. We're jumping the gun here. This is day of the revolution stuff. We'll get there. But whatever you think, currently, the person listening, you have most definitely 110% a skill that would be invaluable to the revolution. So don't be disheartened. Mm-hmm. All right, you don't need to be, you know, the planning guru. You don't need to be what's it called, longitudinal math. I don't fucking know. One of those nerds to be able to.
Also like the person listening who does the organizing. Like you need people from professors to soldiers to union members to managers to civil workers to doctors. etc., etc. Like, keep an open mind on who enters. Obviously, a bit of skepticism before letting them through the door for people who are much closer to capital, obviously, but... I don't think I would be wrong to say that, I don't know, except rapists and pedophiles, pretty much everybody is welcome as long as, you know, they believe in the cause.
Yeah, I mean, remember where Engels came from is the type of thing. It's like people are like, well, exactly. I come from money. It's like, that's okay. Yeah. That's okay. Mm. It's like, yeah. That doesn't make you an evil person. Like, we need all sorts.
Mm. Exactly right. That's the part of the open-mindedness that needs to be approached. You shouldn't allow yourself to devolve into purely ideological dribble, like ultra-left cringe garbage. But again, we're kind of jumping the gun here, which also never made sense to me as an English phrase. What the fuck does that even mean? How would you jump over a gun? Depends on the size of the gun.
It comes from racing, like foot racing.
What?
The gun used to start the race, and you jump the gun as in you start moving before the gun goes off.
Now you still don't jump technically, though, but it makes sense, but it's still stupid.
Yes, agreed.
Anyways, yeah. So essentially, like I was mentioning, yeah, you carry out an appropriate mass line kind of back and forth to create the meat of the political analysis and as well as the political program that you have. At that point, then, it's just popularization of the political program. Many things that we advocate for are generally things that people want, right? The issue is, though, particularly with the American left, my God, the American left, is... they can't make it. They haven't managed to make it attractive, despite the fact that it is in the interest of the vast majority of the American population. Mm-hmm. They're missing that mass line bit of bringing it forward in a language and a context that they would understand. Of course, the history and background of the Red Scare is completely, you know, the anti-communism in the U.S. is of a different breed. JT would know better than I would, but that doesn't change the fact that there is something that can be done. If you think like 1920s China was any friendlier, okay, or, you know, at the same relative period, like 1905 to 1915, Russia was any better, then, you know, I think we shouldn't always be like, oh, no, but we have it harder now. In many ways, we have it far, far easier.
Yeah, many more tools at your disposal, both to educate yourself and to get your message across, things like that. So it's like, don't take the easy way out. Don't, you know, I think part of the problem is a lot of the people, a lot of the quote unquote left in the United States is just liberals who like the aesthetic and the ideas and they haven't done the reading yet. They haven't, they don't really have a good understanding. So they start talking about it. They're, you know, they're genuine about it. They talk about it with their friends. And then one friend says, excuse me, what's neoliberalism? Like a genuine question. And they just don't know how to answer. I was like, and then there you go. Then you look like an idiot, and then they don't take anything you have to say seriously. So it is important to know what you're talking about, you know, even if you're very well-meaning. And I think the left in the U.S. has a lot of work to do in that regard.
Exactly right. One other important, very important aspect, actually, is something that is referred to as dual power structure or building dual power. This is something that's incredibly important prior to any revolutionary activity. And this is across the board. If you were to look at Cuba, if you were to look at Vietnam, China, the USSR and preceding political structures, every single one of them had established essentially some form of dual power. What does this exactly mean? It means two things. Number one, and this is the more fundamental form, I guess, is the creation of networks from this organization that are relatively decentralized, but they do exist, which can be essentially useful in all the functionings, all the requirements of revolutionary activity. This includes military connections at parts. One of the biggest agitation efforts at the time in Russia, for example, was amongst those on the front, which was incredibly important. In other areas, this would be not very successful. I can imagine the United States military sector is not very conducive for this, and that's just because it's a volunteer army currently. There are indications that the United States might need to go back to conscription, and when that happens, you're gonna get a hefty pickings again.
Or a front that is happening locally. You know, somebody's actually moving into American territory, et cetera, et cetera. Again, easy pickings for radicalization.
The People's Army of Canada, yeah.
Exactly right.
I mean, Trudeau just started fucking killing motherfuckers, so in 20 years, Canadian America, I'm sorry, please.
If they purge, they're French. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It was right there. I'm sorry. Another area, of course, is media. This takes a much larger form nowadays than it did back in the day, because media is so ubiquitous. That doesn't mean that it wasn't hugely important. The Pravda, which was the Bolshevik newspaper, had a circulation of 40,000, I think, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you have to remember that what would happen is one guy would buy it and then he'd go and stand in the middle of his factory essentially and be reading it out loud to groups of like 200 workers. Yeah. So the reach went much further. But much more importantly, it was one of the most widely read political newspapers in Tsarist Russia at the time, even though it was illegally spread depending on the time that we're discussing. That goes to show just how important it was to that organizational structure. This goes even more so now. You have to be on, as cringe as stupid as it sounds, you have to be on fucking TikTok, you have to be on YouTube, you have to be on even the fucking the Facebook mom pages, everywhere. Yeah. You have to be ubiquitous. Your message has to be absolutely everywhere, and you have to reiterate it to a point that nobody can do this bullshit where they try to skew what you're saying against you, which is the most common form of anti-communism that we see in the US, for example. I keep referring to the US because the US is the preeminent anti-communist power. They've turned it into an art.
And at one point, like, lack of class consciousness should be in people's heads defined as, I don't know, being like childish, like unwise, or against one's own interests or that of society. And, you know, sorry for my French, but a pussy bitch loser who likes quite literally to be stepped on, and obviously not in a hot way, which I love. But ironically, you gotta play to a wide range of reasons why members and future members of a particular organization would, in the first place, develop class consciousness, and, you know, then work them down. And that is obviously done through many, many, let's call them funnels and pieces of, in this case, media, and also directly physically inside of the organization itself. But as Hakim put, it needs to be fucking drilled down, not to the basics, but drilled down to a point at which it is no longer even questionable. It's like gravity. Yeah. It's like, this is logical. Because, unironically, compared to fascists, we have a bit of an easier job here. It is true. It is actually true. Okay.
So this is probably the hardest part, though, in advanced capitalist economies like the U.S., to establish that the importance of class consciousness. We are so incredibly brainwashed by anti-communist propaganda that anything even remotely critical of the free market is immediately dismissed as heresy by the average person. And, you know, that
and you have high standards as well. I mean, that's the problem of the whole first world. Sorry for interrupting. Yeah, we talked about it before. You know, we have it easier in certain aspects. We have it harder. But ironically, as ironic as it is, and this has been said by much more brilliant Marxists than me, you know, why it's less likely, but we'll talk about this later, about, you know, for a revolution to happen in the first world, is quite literally, where's the fucking motivation, blood? And then on top of that, what JT beautifully said, you know, almost, I mean, literally almost 100 years of Red Scare propaganda together with, you know, why the fuck should I care? Even though they're on loans, I got two cars and a house. Nah. You know, suck my dick.
Nihilism, yeah. Capitalist nihilism and supreme anti-communism is a disgusting combination, but it's very effective.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that we can't get through to these people, you know? Yeah. I think all of us can attest to that. We've all gotten comments or emails from people thanking us for changing their minds. It's, you know, it's just that the deeply...
You mean brainwashing?
But you don't even need to. Like, they might have a house and two cars alone. Their kids are not. And then their kids' kids are definitely not. Well, following rate of profit, suck at my dick. No, yes, absolutely this. But also, like, it is inevitable. This, you can't, like, keep paying the tab for have the future generations keep paying your tab. You cannot. Point. Eventually, it like, class consciousness is absolutely inevitable. Or, unfortunately, also, you know, reactionary sentiment, which that at the end of the day can be.
That's one thing that is important to keep in mind. You know, even if we consider it to be inevitable, which, you know, can be a dangerous perspective, I think, in some cases, oh, it will happen, it will happen. But, you know, it takes work too. It takes time and patience and a different approach for each person you speak to. And if we want to be brutally honest, like you were saying with the reactionary stuff, some people are just a lost cause. You might not win over Uncle Steve. You know, you have to use your time and energy wisely. You have to learn to identify who has the potential for positive change and who doesn't. And I think that Yugopnik is right that ridicule, or at least harsh criticism, can be a useful tool in helping stubborn people adjust their perspective, or probably more accurately, showing others in the orbit of that stubborn person that you're a loser if you don't have class consciousness. Like, no one likes to be attacked directly, but everybody loves to gossip about the shortcomings of others. So if, you know, if that becomes a gossip point, or like, oh, you know, he's not class conscious, he doesn't understand the inherent contradictions of the capitalist system. Ooh.
He listens to Ben Shapiro.
Yeah, exactly. Then that'll start to kind of snowball, and people are like, oh, he is a loser, isn't he?
Like, it needs to be a similar thing to like when somebody, you know, just like in capitalism, somebody just managed to get some money, and immediately and they go and buy a fancy car. Everybody's like, dude, this is so irrational. At least, you know, semi-financially conscious people.
All right.
Dude, that's what the fuck. Same as somebody, you know, you go to work, you go to the factory, you go to the corporate office, you go to wherever, and you see somebody like working their fucking dick off in order to, you know, satisfy the boss. At pre-revolutionary stages, the perspective towards that should inherently be like, the fuck is this motherfucker doing? Like, this is fucking imbecilic. Levels of class consciousness need to be achieved both inside of the organization and outside. But obviously, there's going to be a lot of Uncle Joes and so on, whose minds are not necessarily going to be changed. But NPCs are going to be NPCs during a revolution, before a revolution, and after a revolution. You think every single member of a future socialist society is, you know, going to be a sharp believer in socialism? Just how, like, I don't know, I can't use a percentage, but not everybody is called, you know, wakes up in the morning, he's like, now I'm going to go and serve capitalism because is the greatest, you know, mode of production. They're just going to be, you know, bystanders and so on. As long as they do not take up arms. Exactly. As long as they do not take part in ideological reproduction of reactionary sentiment, or do not directly counteract socialist perspectives, then let them be fucking bystanders. We will help them even if they do not want to be helped. Mm-hmm. God bless, you know, a great Christian and Muslim kind of perspective to have. But
Ayn Rand still got an education from the Soviets. Honestly, exactly. The only mistake that the Soviets made.
But yeah, eventually it spreads, and to the ones that it doesn't need to.
Yeah.
There's several points that I would like to make. Oh, very beautifully said from both of you. I would say to add on to JT's points that we should be careful with thinking that things are socialism is inevitable. Socialism isn't inevitable. What is inevitable is the point at which the class contradictions that currently exist and the contradictions of capitalism get to such a point, that the tension reaches such a point that the appropriate moment for revolution and the transition to socialism presents itself. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue is we need to be ready for that, right? Organizations need to be in place. The work needs to be done amongst the relevant, you know, class groupings that we're trying to reach, all that. And when that happens, then we can actually take advantage of the situation and bring about, or attempt to bring about, a better world for the vast majority of people. Otherwise, then we just end up falling into reaction and all that kind of bullshit.
Like, look, if you had one shot or one opportunity, this bomb is where you need, like famously said by Stalin, you know?
Exactly right. Dude, now because of the AI edits, some people have taken some Stalin speeches and his voice, and they've started doing, him speaking, but people don't know Stalin's voice, right? So just, but yeah, somebody needs to make this edit. Anyways, that's the first point. The second point is the thing about media and spreading to media, building these networks, particularly within the media, is our message has to be so ubiquitous and explicit in what we want to bring about. Of course, after the process of the mass line and correct analysis, blah, 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 it has to be so explicit that nobody can even dare to try to paint what you want incorrectly. As in, for example, they're like, oh, we want to take your toothbrush. It has to be so clear. It's like, that's clearly not what they want, because I see it on the walls every time I go to work, and it's on my fucking TV screen, and it's on my however ways that you can try to make it happen. But that's, you know, they can't deny, or they can't try to paint you as some fucking caricature, right? To quote Lenin, with Marxism, they love to, instead of paint a straw man, Marxism, then defeat the straw man and then just like prance around. That's a bad paraphrasing of Lenin, but you know what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. That's point number two. About the point with Yugopnik where you mentioned the motivations of advanced capitalist countries currently and whether they want revolution or not, you can refer to a very good and balanced discussion about this. You refer to our episode where we interviewed Torkel Lausanne, where we go into this point. Otherwise, you can read Torkel Lausanne's books, which go very deeply into this point. The global perspective is I think his best and most concise work about this currently. But we'll delve deeper into this point in once we get to the day of the revolution, or preliminary post-revolutionary period.
If I can just hop in real quick and return to the ubiquity of the message thing, I think right now what we have is the complete opposite of what we need. We have the right, who has completely dominated the messaging for what communism is, what the left is. So, you know, you go on YouTube and you're immediately served not one, but like 15 videos by right-wing hacks like Jordan Peterson, yeah. Ben Shapiro, all the rest. And they're all giving you the same bullet points that socialists do want to take your toothbrush, you know. They do want to trample your freedoms. They do want to establish the gay caliphate, you know, whatever yeah. whatever it is.
They all want you to sleep under one blanket. Yeah,
exactly. So that is they understand the importance of the ubiquity of the message. And so we need to tear that down, but do what they have done. Look to them as an example of how to do it correctly, because they're very good at it.
Yeah, keep in mind that they can manage to do this because they have tremendous fucking
enormous
wealth behind them.
Unfathomable.
Like beyond. Yeah. If anybody ever wonders, by the way, the left is supposed to be the fucking postmodern. If that was truly the case, then you would see these perspectives that we're trying to bring forward actually everywhere. You don't see that. You see lukewarm liberal bullshit and the vomit and vitriol and just disgusting nonsense that you see. The toxic waste that spilled from the mouths of the Crowders and Shapiros and all the other garbage that exists. Going back to the point of dual power, of course, I was mentioning the networks that you're establishing. We're still in the preliminary, you know, like the basic networks that are being established. We mentioned military connections of all sorts. We mentioned, for example, media, student groups, and existence within like almost all levels of education you can get into, particularly universities, because these have been very fruitful areas for this. One mistake is to focus on student groups. A revolution is not made of students. No revolution has ever been made successfully carried out by students. It's usually more of the adventurous, elitist type of, you know, cringe. So you want to avoid that. But students are still very fruitful for this, because the students of today that are studying the relevant things, that are ideologically motivated, will be the people who manage to apply through the expertise that they've picked up all the daily motions and requirements of the state and running all the important things that we need to once they, you know, once the revolution does come. So that's also incredibly important. Of course, meeting the demands and requirements and wishes of all sorts of minority groups that are progressive, of course. I'm sure the KKK is technically a minority group in the United States. It doesn't mean that we need to meet what they're saying. This is part of the correct analysis.
Miami
again.
Cubans, yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. So you do need to be aware of all these points. This is, there's many more, you know, like preliminary networks that need to be established, but I'll move on from this point and then move on to the secondary, much more larger dual power point, which differs depending on the region and country and time and level of revolutionary development that you have. In some places, it was as simple as just having a network of getting messages across, essentially, that the state couldn't be, or, you know, the repressive arms of the state couldn't get to. This is like more to the Cuban example. To other examples where you had entire cities and industry and like dams and stuff built and controlled and maintained by the communists in China before they, this is years before they took power, right? They had entire regions that were like red bases, essentially, which had their own, essentially, like microcosm or they want for the rest of China to be. This included like their own administrative structure. This included their own currency or like issuing of like an entire state functioning and everything in between. The Soviet example is kind of in between the two. The Soviets, meaning the councils that existed within Petrograd and then eventually Moscow and a bunch of other cities, had enough representatives between and enough clout to the general population to be able to essentially skirt the administrative directives of the central government at the time. They became more important and more representative of political will, not only like ideologically, but also through the ability to execute on what was being passed, than the central government, these Soviets, these councils. The way that these can be built are very numerous, and it depends on the stage of the struggle. I can't give you a blueprint. None of this is meant to be a blueprint. It's just supposed to get you to think. But a concrete study of the Cuban, Russian, and Chinese examples would get you very far in understanding exactly what you're supposed to do. If you want a very concrete example of the preliminary stages of this, the Black Panthers in the U.S.
Yeah.
Would be the best example for something that is, what would you say, in an advanced capitalist country, essentially, that is still heavily ruled by capital. They got very far. They were nipped in the bud, sadly. They could have become way bigger and way more important, way more influential and all that, but they were, you know, they got the...
And combined with other organizations and so on, but yeah.
Yeah, they got the COINTELPRO special. They got steamrolled, unfortunately. They were so cool, all the stuff they did. Alas. Anyway, an easy way to think of to remember the dual power stuff is just your goal is to establish a government in waiting. You know, you want to be prepared to step in when the time comes for stepping in. That's about that. You know, all this stuff is very, you know, that's super simple. But if you're trying to explain it to somebody, that's a good way to do it.
No, exactly right.
And you need, especially like since you mentioned the Black Panthers, you need an insanely strong vetting process, obviously, for leadership. All other groups, in my opinion, must work as cells. I mean, we saw that specifically with Bolsheviks. So while they are, at least before, you know, the actual revolution started, back before they were organizing and so on. So, you know, while the cells are connected to the center, and they can get information and orders from the center, if they are to be infiltrated, taken over, or sabotaged, they do not hurt the center per se. A modern example of this is obviously, like, this is not a good example, but it's how cartels work and why cartels have managed to exist for so long, no matter how much money was invested in order to destroy them. Obviously, additionally, to once you create these organizations, you need to not just to exist in your own little bubble or whatever the fuck, but you need to actually create a presence in the communities you are in, as obviously Hakim said. But now, I don't know, apply to literally what can you do physically. Let's use like super random examples, as for example, food banks or donation centers or, like, you know, ecological task force, or I don't know, depending on the culture of the particular country you live in, even, you know, small community protecting militia and so on. But, you know, make sure all of this, most of our listeners probably know and shit, but one thing, like, always make sure to, like, actually involve the local community in the tasks that you're doing, because a lot of people go out and they help a lot of people, right? They go out and they help a lot. They get a lot of homeless people fed, they, you know, get some pedophiles or some drug dealers or whatever the fuck, depending on the country, what is popular and so on. But once you actually get the local community to participate in the things that you're doing, they are much more likely going to choose to join or change their opinion about your particular organization and so on. Specifically, if we talk about food banks, don't just, you know, go and, you know, now it's me, JT, and Hakim, and we're feeding all these people. No, invite people from that particular neighborhood to also come be part of the organization. They don't have to pay anything. For example, they can just be, you know, the people that are serving the soup, the people that are there, and you guys are going to bring the food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You get to talking and you get to expanding. Super ridiculously tiny, tiny example. But once, when organizations are actually trying to do good things for the community, yes, great, bravo, tap yourself on the back, you're really helping people around. But remember, this is going to sound disgusting, but I don't care. But remember, but that this is another tactic of getting people also on your side. So while help, it's a win-win. Go out, help out, but remember the core reason why you're doing this. And that is the long-term goal of revolution, which can only be achieved by getting people on your fucking boat.
A good analogy for this is Mao's quote, which is the party cadre, so a member of the organization, should be like a fish in water, and the water is the masses, the groups of people you're trying to reach. You have to be completely fluid to move through them, right, as if you're part of them and one with them, but also be distinct in your ideological role, because at the end of the day, you're supposed to be impacting a particular. What we are doing is not charity, because charity, at the end of the day, the way that Western charity is currently set up is completely inefficacious. It's not meant to change anything. We don't want charity. What we want to do is we want to ideologically educate people through positive work that could look like charity. And in the end, through this, essentially show, like, this is what we can do with such simple, basic things that we have at our disposal. Imagine if we had the actual powers and tools of the state to be able to administer all these things correctly and appropriately, so they could be more equally spread. Everybody can have equitable access, and it could be affordable or completely free, depending on the healthcare, for example, education, etc.
And also picking the leadership, obviously now different ideological currents inside of Marxism will very intensively disagree on this. But, you know, whatever field you're in, be it, you know, you need an actual leadership who represents the most knowledgeable, most experienced cadres of different aspects of what a particular revolutionary organization needs to do. Or, I don't know, you're an anarchist and, you know, we gotta vote if we're gonna take a shit now or after we march 5 miles down the line. I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm not making fun. I love them. But no matter where you stand, you need to always remember that you can't really run an organization that is talking about how at the end of the day they're going to whose long-term goal is the destruction of unjustified hierarchies, right? And then you are sticking to your position as the big man, as if like this is the only thing that you ever wanted in life. Everyone serves their particular purpose inside of a particular organization. If you have the particular skills that are necessary for management and leadership, you should be there because that is what your skills can do. Yeah. You being in management or leadership does not mean that you are better than the guy working the fucking latrines. You are just better at this. He, unfortunately, is better. Bad example, but you get my point. Better at that. There is no, obviously, there is kind of more stress in certain positions versus others, but you should never start developing the feeling of superiority inside of the organization only because you, funnily enough, are in a position that in capitalism and in, capitalist ideology is defined as more important.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of trying to abolish that whole thing. And I see very much in you guys have probably seen it, be it in fledgling organizations or larger, obviously not to the level of revolutionary that we're talking about here, but, a lot of organizations kind of dying out because somebody, just gets to the top position and just grinds it to the halt because of poor management, but they don't want to step down because they think that they know best.
More importantly, I think, and this adds on to Yuvapnik's point, is that no matter what form of leadership organization you decide on, of course, democratically, blah, 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 in some cases it needs to be centralized and in some cases it has to be decentralized. That's the correct approach. It depends on your material conditions. In some cases, you're going to need to be completely, almost independently acting in different sectors. In other cases, you're going to have essentially unity to the point of being one fist, particularly in very straight. This comes very close to the day of the revolutionary, preliminary post-revolutionary period. That's kind of the importance, really, of a strict unity comes into play, because a house divided, there's an American saying, a house divided
cannot stand. Yeah,
exactly right, thank you. Amongst other things that we can build on in those relative episodes. All right, with all this being said, this is the first part of a three-part series that we're planning on. This is the right before the revolution bit. The next episode, inshallah, will be the day of the revolution, so the actual happenings in the 24, 48, 72 hours of what's going on, what needs to occur in that first immediate point. And of course, the final part will be the preliminary post-revolutionary period. So this is the first weeks and months of revolution. To kind of summarize what we said here today, all this, of course, as mentioned, is not a blueprint. This is a summary and a creative retelling, let's say, of historical examples, as well as essentially what theory teaches us. And that's why it's very important to read theory so that you can get to the nitty-gritty of this and also see where the pitfalls are and what worked. Of course, an analysis of history and a correct political analysis of history follows. But to kind of summarize all of it into one point, fundamentally, no revolutionary movement exists without revolutionary theory, of course. Once you have revolutionary theory, you need to have organizations. Organizations are the bread and butter of which is to actually know what you're talking about. The base of this organizational structure is, number one, a correct political analysis, meaning a class analysis of the area or society and time that you're currently living in, and as well as a creative application of the mass line. This will allow you to develop a skeleton of a political program that will then afterwards also allow you to populate said skeleton with the important and attractive points that you can bring to the working class or whatever other classes you're trying to attract towards this proletarian socialist movement to bring about socialism. You have to be very aware that at some points revolution is not feasible, and other points it is very, very feasible. The point of an organization is to always be ready, theoretically, as well as have the rapport with the general population to be able to jump into action when it needs to happen. The point that brings revolution forward, as Lenin said, there are days where years happen and years where days happen. It can come like that, right? And if it does come in such a sudden way, to be caught with your pants down, as Americans say, where you haven't done the appropriate political work, you haven't been talking to people, you haven't developed a proper and accurate political program, you have not developed anything that resembles a mass line, then this is just essentially handing over the period of crisis to the reaction. And this will result not only in the killing and imprisoning and oppression of a vast majority of all the undesirables which I think every single person listening to this at some point or another could be considered.
Yeah.
So it's incredibly dangerous. But also, it is a severe failing of the entire point of the organization. Much more importantly, when you develop this political program and the necessarily, you know, mass line points, you need to start bringing the work much more publicly. You need to develop appropriate networks. This goes into the point of the, you know, general as well as more central executively and concretely formed dual power. In the preliminary stage, it's appropriate connections with military groups, with student groups and other minority associated groups that are positive, mind you. So not the KKK, as mentioned. You need to have connections with the media and be able to make your message absolutely ubiquitous so people cannot deny you, or much worse, try to paint you as some, you know, completely misconstrue what you're trying to say intentionally, misrepresent what you're trying to do so that they could discredit you. Of course, this more concrete form of dual power is usually more politically oriented to allow yourself to kind of establish a independent political structure, essentially, as JT said, a government in waiting. This is incredibly important, and this is the example best illustrated by the Chinese in their revolution. And of course, always, always, always reiterate, you have to be firmly grounded in a correct political line, which is centered on an appropriate class analysis of your current material conditions, of the class groups that you have in society, the contradictions that exist, and which contradictions are resolvable, which aren't, what that resolution will particularly look like. Again, not to re-emphasize this point too much, but the Chinese example is the Chinese Revolution is the example of how this was done in a very detailed way. Of course, the Soviets need to be analyzed too, and likewise with the Cuban idea. Much more importantly, stay safe.
Buy merch. Because, the first step of a revolution is buying merch. Exactly. Off of three fucking dudes with a microphone.
Exactly right. So yes, buy merch. Support us on Patreon, unironically.
Give money, give gold.
And this has been the Deprogram. I'm Hakim.
I'm JT.
And I'm Hugo Opnik, and revolutionary vegetarian dick is the best.